Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. Today is a special Mother's Day broadcast. My guest is Dr. Christine Gross-Lowe. She is the author of several parenting books and also a contributor to Mothering.com. Dr. Christine and I will be discussing her latest book titled Parenting Without Borders: Surprising Lessons Parents Around the World Can Teach Us. It is a narrative and research-backed exploration of the myriad ways parents raise their children around the world. Good morning, Christine. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
I'm delighted to have you on the show. I think you have so much to offer. The book is fantastic. Parenting Without Borders is very informative. The book offers a fresh perspective for parents who seek to understand how children are being raised around the world. And I'm excited about that because I was raised in Malaysia. So I'm interested in bantering with you a little bit about, about some of the things that were mentioned in the book. And I believe for sure the saying, it only takes one woman to give birth to a child, but it takes a village to raise one, certainly applies in this situation. So congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Okay, well, my parents were immigrants from South Korea, and they came to this country shortly before I was born. They came to the United States, and I was born a year after they got here in 1968. And I grew up basically in a small town in Pennsylvania. There were no other Asian families around, really. We were one of the only ones there. And so we grew up in a, you know, a very comfortable small town environment, rather idyllic. And as I got older, though, I began to become more interested in the country that my parents had come from and how that had sort of shaped my own childhood growing up, because, you know, there was the culture outside our home, and then, of course, there was the culture within our home, and it was sort of a hybrid. And so when I, you know, when I got to college, I took a year. I went to South Korea for a year and spent an exchange year there. And then I eventually ended up doing a doctorate in East Asian history. So, and I spent a lot of time in Asia then as a, you know, during my 20s. And then I lived there again after having two of my four children. My husband and I moved there and lived in Japan for 5 years. And we raised, and we eventually had two more children. We raised our children there, and we still go back there frequently.
The first question I have for you is, do you cook kalbi barbecue?
Oh, I do. We're all big fans of Korean food in our house.
I understand that. I love Korean food. I did not realize Korean food are very spicy, and I love spicy food.
Yeah, it is spicy, and the really interesting thing is that, well, I sort of remember this from when I was growing up, is that children in Korea learn to eat this spicy food from the time they're very little, as children in all sorts of cultures do, you know, get used to their own cuisine.
Wonderful. When did you decide to pursue an in-depth look into the art of parenting?
Well, let's see. I was interested in... I was interested in parenting once I became a parent. When my first child was born in 2000, in the year 2000, I was really quite struck by how many parenting books there were out there, and how people held very tightly to their ideas about what good parenting might be. Some of this meshed with what I knew from growing up, and some of it was very different from the childhood that I myself had experienced. So I was always very interested in the fact that there are so many strong ideas and, you know, passionate ideas about what it means and what it takes to be a good parent. But I didn't really, you know, I have been a freelance writer, and I've written articles on parenting. My last book was on, you know, an aspect of parenting. And so I suppose this is a topic that I gravitate to because it's so much a part of what my daily life is all about, raising four children. And then with this book, you know, I had always wondered about these ideas about the fact that parents in different cultures seem to have different views or different notions about what it means to be a good parent. But it wasn't until we were actually preparing to come back to the United States that I began to really intensively think about looking into global parenting a lot more.
Very interesting. So you had the opportunity to sort of flavor the different parenting style and techniques, I guess, as you travel around the world. And that sort of kicked in the idea of, you know, like, well, cool. Obviously, there's some good, bad, and ugly as well.
Exactly. There is. And no culture is perfect. But every culture has something, I think, that we can learn from, even if it's just to compare it to our own and see why we do what we do and why others do what they do.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. So how were you raised?
Let's see. It's funny. When I was growing up, I thought my parents were, you know, stricter than my friends' parents around me at times. And yet, looking back and reflecting on it, they were actually quite lenient, always incredibly warm and supportive. So that goes there right against the whole, you know, stereotype about, what Asian parenting can be like. In my experience, And what I've observed, it's extremely warm. It's physically warm. There's a lot of support. There's a lot of belief that you can, you know, do good things with your life. And my parents were very supportive, particularly of the fact that my brothers and I all went into sort of artistic fields in the end. I went into writing, and I have one brother who's a photographer, a photojournalist, and another who's a symphony conductor. And these are all, you know, these are all professions that are definitely on the creative side, and you really, it takes being able to accept that you are going to have children who are comfortable thinking outside the box. And so I'm really appreciative when I look back on my childhood at how flexible my parents were.
What were your parents' vocations?
My father was a doctor, and my mother was a violinist.
Okay. That's interesting. It's a wonderful mix of the sciences and the arts as well.
Mm-hmm.
And what you brought up is very interesting, because growing up in Malaysia and growing up in the Eastern culture, and I understand what you're talking about, usually it's like, son, you don't think about G.I. Joe. You don't think about being a fireman. You think about being a doctor, lawyer, and whatnot. And so having someone that truly supports you in terms of your own personal creative ideas and so forth, your own creativity, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later, about you talking about personal geniuses and whatnot, and it's very, very interesting. These are the things that are kind of unique, because your parents certainly did not raise their family in accordance to, in some ways, the cultural norm.
Right, and I like to actually, I like that we have that personal example that I can point to, because I think part of what my book is about is breaking down these stereotypes that we have about all sorts of cultures and what they're like. And the most important thing to remember is that parents in all cultures raise their children to thrive in the societies that they're going to be, you know, living in. And, and this is what shapes their parenting and makes it look sometimes unfamiliar to us. It really is helpful, because then we can turn the lens back on ourselves and see, oh, what we're doing is it's not universal. It's we have these assumptions that we may not be aware of, but they're all geared toward raising children who are going to thrive in our society.
Right, and that society may not be Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Right.
And people need to realize that, yeah.
Yes, I mean, I think the great challenge, and, you know, it's an exciting challenge for the future, is to raise children who will truly be global citizens. To me, that's a very important thing, and you know, it's not just personally important to me. It's clear that that is a direction that we need to be moving in.
Right. The way you do it, of course, is a step-by-step process, because first, junior do need to learn how to survive in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and then afterwards America, and then let's look at the global picture as a whole.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Wonderful. When did the idea of Parenting Without Borders come about?
Well, let's see. So I was writing on and off. A lot of the writing was actually just for myself, trying to process this experience that my family and I were having when we were living in Japan and raising children there, where things are very, very different. And it really kind of shook me to the core at times because, you know, my specialty had been Japanese and Korean history. And so you'd think that I'd know more than I did when it actually came to raising children in a different culture and watching how parents socialize their children to become competent members of their society. And, you know, at first I had a lot of doubts about some of the things I was seeing. I felt like, you know, I was very used to a cultural norm where parents are very involved with their children's lives in a very sort of emotionally supportive way, in a way that looked familiar to me. That's and then what we saw in Japan was that that kind of support is there. It's there, and they love their children just as much, and yet they show this sort of support for their children in different ways. They, you know, one phrase I have in my book is that they believe in a child's strength, and I think that in our country there is a little bit more of a script. I'm not saying that every parent does this, but there's more of a an idea that, you know, our children are there for us to protect, and that's, you know, that's a very, very good sentiment. It's just that when it goes too far, it undermines children because then they become they lose confidence in their own ability to do things. And this is something that I saw cultivated in Japan very much. So what, you know, so in essence, my husband and I were sort of raising our children in a more hybrid way once we saw that, you know, there were a lot of benefits to the way children were turning out in Japan. Our children's classmates, the friends they'd come home with, there were a lot of things that they did that I wouldn't commonly see if they were bringing their American classmates home. And so, you know, children were very self-reliant. Self-reliant in a different way. You know, they didn't have to ask me. They would take care of their belongings. They would get themselves home on time. I didn't have to remind them or wait for a parent to pick them up or anything. These are very young children, like as young as the age of six.
Right.
And there are many other ways that I saw this kind of self-reliance that we wanted to adapt and teach our own children. So that brings me back to, you know, this hybrid approach for parenting. I began to wonder if Japanese child-rearing has given us some of these lessons, what are some surprising lessons that I might learn if I were to talk to other parents in other parts of the world? And so, you know, I decided to turn that into a book and really set out to investigate this question. Are there surprising lessons that parents around the world can teach us? And if so, what are they? And, you know, I wanted to really share that with my readers.
Fantastic. I think what you did is just wonderful because these are the things that you can read about it, but unless you are actually living and experiencing on a day-to-day basis in the different cultures, you would not be able to get the actual feeling of how things are conducted. And I can certainly understand when you mentioned about the self-reliant and so forth that the Japanese share with their children is simply because, again, that's how they were brought up over a period of time, over generations. And people may not realize this. These are the generations that actually went through World War II, where you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. So self-reliant is so important. Here, we have been relatively safe over since, I guess, the turn of the century. And I'm not talking about the 21st century, the 20th century. So the gear system that we are involved with as far as parenting and family is concerned is on a different speed.
Right. It's a more comfortable feeling. So I know exactly what you mean. Yes. I think that, you know, actually past generations in the U.S. also, and that's one of the other things that I discovered when I was researching this book is that, you know, as anyone knows, just looking back on their own childhood, parenting here has shifted a great deal, and we have become more protective of our children. The sort of definition of what good parenting is has definitely changed over time. But the memory of the hardships of, for instance, World War II or the Korean War, et cetera, are still sort of present in Asia in a way that they're not here. And there's a kind of a toughening notion, for instance, in a lot of the Scandinavian cultures that I looked at and parents that I spoke to, this is not considered being, you know, a mean parent. It's kind of a good thing that you do to help your child prepare for life.
Right, right. Very true. One scenario for myself, and I was growing up in Malaysia, this was obviously a few years back, it's very interesting because my parents grew up during Second World War. They were obviously very, very young at that time, but it was very interesting, and you know this for sure, and I don't know whether everyone practices this in Asian culture, but I knew when I was growing up, whatever you put on your plate, you better finish it.
Right, yes, exactly, yes. That's something that, you know, I think that in this country we are very worried about causing eating disorders or other such things. But what I discovered and was extremely surprised by in Japan was this idea that you must, you know, you must always finish what's on your plate. You must not waste food. It's a moral sort of good to... And the thing that I really liked about it and the lesson that I took from it was not that, you know, I don't want to force my children to finish all the food that is in front of them. It's that they should learn. I think that it's a really good lesson that they learned that you should feel gratitude for your food, that it doesn't just come, you know, out of a box or a can or something. It really has a history. It comes from someone. It comes from a farmer or an animal or somebody has helped to bring that, you know, the people who helped to prepare that food and put it on your plate. These are lessons that our children were explicitly taught in Japanese school, and I know other Japanese parents have said this, and I know that in Korea as well, this is something that I heard a lot about growing up, how precious food is.
Right.
And I think that it's so easy to take it for granted when we live in a country with such abundance.
Right.
But I also found that there's a real wisdom in a way of eating that I think we might in our culture look at as stifling, because clearly, you know, in Japan and Korea, for instance, obesity rates are far lower than our own.
Right.
They're the lowest in the developed world, and it's the same in other countries which teach eating very specifically and sort of deliberately, such as France.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a really interesting lesson there for us.
There's a sense of responsibility that goes with that, because what I was taught about is that, hey, don't be greedy, think about everybody else, and guess what? You never know when your next meal is coming. So eat what you have and be grateful, like you mentioned, about that, and that's important. And the most important thing, there's so many subliminal lessons, I guess, that goes with it in some ways, like we talk about the sense of responsibility and don't be a glut and so forth. So besides nutrition itself, it gives you a sense of responsibility. And these
Absolutely.
Are the sense of responsibility being taught, rather like, let's have you and I go sit in the living room and lesson 101. It doesn't work that way.
Right. No, it's very integrated. It's integrated into all aspects of living. And that's what I think, you know, we want to raise responsible, mindful, and kind children. And I think that there are so many sort of opportunities that are not quite on our radar, but could be. And this is sort of one of them. It's really, and in fact, school lunch in Japan is an actual class in the, you know, it's on a part of their curriculum, because it's kind of a more holistic view about what it takes to educate a child to become an adult.
Can you give us a summary of each of the country that is covered in your book and their strongest parenting contribution to the book?
Okay, well, I can give you a summary of a few. There's so many that are mentioned. Some are mentioned more than others. I think that, you know, when I went to Finland, I was quite struck by how the children were playing outside so much, something I'd heard of, you know, but was really true. And they actually have some school days are as short as 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the, you know, Finnish teenagers are among the highest academic achievers in the world. And so I was really struck by this sort of dissonance between what we think more is better. And in Finland, when it comes to education, in Finland, the idea is not more is better. You just have to pay attention to what that education consists of. And frequent breaks, which is really common also in Asian schools, there's a lot of physical education, for instance, in Japan, as well as recess. There's a lot of recess, and that's just a given. So I, you know, the one lesson from Finland that I learned and from other countries was that you really do need to move your body to be able to learn. Mm-hmm. That's really important, and to move it frequently and to just have that kind of unfettered time to play freely. Another lesson, you know, when I went to China, I met teachers, several of them told me this sort of story about reaching for an apple, because I was asking, well, so is there a secret to motivating children that you can share with me? I'm very interested in hearing that from, you know, people in all cultures. And they said, well, mm-hmm. you think of it as an apple that's sort of dangling just a little out of reach, and you really want to make the child feel like they can get that apple. They can sort of reach for it. It's almost like climbing a mountain, and they can climb partway up, and you know, they might be groaning, and it might just feel so hard to them. But when they're sort of halfway there, just as when they've almost touched that apple, you can show them, look how close you are to the top. Look behind you. Look how far you've come. And then when they get that apple, you know, or when they climb that mountain, you really celebrate that achievement with them. You show them, you know, I knew you could do it. Have a lot of belief and faith in them. And the other thing that I found very interesting about China, and I think this pertains to a lot of East Asian cultures, is that, you know, we tend to think of the idea of sort of family obligation as not cool when you become a teenager. It's, you're supposed to pull away. You're supposed to become really, you know, independent and separate from your parents. And there is a place for that, but there's also... there's also in Asia a little bit less, there's a little, how do I put it? They're not afraid to sort of say to the child, you know, doing well in school is a good thing for you, and it's a good thing for your family, and we really expect you to be able to do as well as you can. And that sort of combination of high expectations and high support has been shown in research, not just in Asia, but in America as well, to have benefits, to mm-hmm. to help children to achieve better in school. And so mm-hmm. I thought that was very interesting. The lesson that I learned living in Japan was just that children are stronger than we think, and that making an effort, making a sincere effort at whatever you do is really the most important thing. It's not necessarily about achievement, the way that we tend to stereotype. It's really about putting forth your most sincere effort. And mm-hmm. there, too, the research backs up the idea that when you praise a child for their achievements, for instance, you can make a child afraid to try harder next time because they have something they have to live up to. But if you're praising them for effort, if you're encouraging them and showing them, you know, they can keep trying and they can keep doing it, children will then want to do more. And so that's a very sort of, you know, mm-hmm. those are lessons that I feel that we can incorporate in our own lives.
Very interesting. One of the things that I gather is not doing things in excess, because mm-hmm. you can always, whether you like it or not, you may not realize this, you may underpraise or you may overpraise.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
so it's living too much to the left and to the right.
Right.
It's
right.
a dangerous
yeah.
scenario, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, I think, yes, being moderate about all of this is, you know, their parents who appraise their child for drinking a glass of water, et cetera. That sort of praise is not only unnecessary, it really undermines the praise that comes when, you know, they've really done something or they've really put forth an effort that is worth praising. But, of course, parents, you know, the last thing I would want is for parents to overthink this and think, oh, I'm overpraising mm-hmm. or underpraising. I think doing what feels natural, but just knowing that there are all these other ways out there can be a kind of backdrop against what you ultimately do that's best for you and your own family.
Right. And one of the things also, I do want to mention this, one of the reasons I knew growing up, I guess, from the Eastern culture, the Asian culture, so to speak, the praise are limited in the sense that they want to teach, again, we talked about there's some value-added things in mm-hmm. the way they do things, is that mm-hmm. it's to teach humility, to be mm-hmm. humble. Don't get your head to be too big, and then you will have that sense of arrogance, so to speak. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference between confident and being mm-hmm. arrogant.
Exactly. And I write about that, the difference between false confidence and true confidence. And it's mm-hmm. not reflected. It's not, you know, we, one of the things I'll say that our children thought was really interesting when we came back was that here it is, it's not only okay, it's kind of expected to speak well about yourself, what you do or whatever, to say I'm awesome, you know. This was really startling at first because in Japan that was not encouraged at all. But
right.
It didn't mean that children were not confident. In fact, I was very struck in one time I was watching this boy. He's about 12 years old, 11 years old. He was giving a speech in front of 150 people at a Japanese elementary school about his goals for the coming summer because they do swimming every summer during school. And basically he stood up there and he listed everything he hadn't been able to do. Last year I didn't do this, I wasn't able quite to do this, I really didn't, you know, I really tried but I couldn't quite, you know, swim fast enough, etc. And yet, you know, this is an incredibly confident boy, and he was confident enough to be able to stand up there and say what he hadn't succeeded at because those were his new goals. That's what he wanted to do in the future. And that kind of confidence, a mixture of confidence and also self-reflection.
I understand what you're talking about in terms of there is a very fine line between confidence and, of course, being arrogance. But I think at the same time also, depending on the circumstance and situation, because here in the United States, we are obviously driven to self-expressions and the feeling
right.
that we can accomplish a lot of things. And it's because, again, in the environment that we're in. So having said that, what is America's family's contribution to your book?
Well, it's actually, this is part of it, exactly what we've been talking about, is kind of we give our children this belief that they can do anything. And if we back that up with true support, you know, good, thorough support for their, you know, for them to be able to gain the skills that would allow them to unleash this potential, it would be an amazing combination. And I really love that about American parenting, that we have such belief in our children and that we want to try, we want to be good parents. We really take that seriously. We parent our children with a lot of warmth and you know, expressions of love that to me are very familiar and feel good to me and feel good to my children. We tell them we love them. We you know, we hug them a lot. We often do things for them, and that is an expression of love. We provide for them. These are great contributions that in my own hybrid sort of parenting paradigm are a very essential part of what it means to be a good parent. To be the best parent that I can be.
Wonderful. So real quickly, please share with us 10 parenting lessons from around the world.
10 parenting lessons. Let's see.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I'm sure you have more than that, but we'll stick with 10.
Well, okay, I'll try to give you a little variety of from some different countries. You know, these are to take or not as you will. One thing that I learned is that children should climb trees. And, you know, it's something that I did when I was little, but I was actually very, I was noticing that not all parents that we would hang out with here were comfortable letting their children climb the tree in our yard. I found out from a Norwegian researcher that taking certain risks, such as climbing trees, you know, something that we think of as sort of risky, is actually a good way for kids to stay safe because taking risks helps them to meet their need for challenge, and it also hones their judgment about what their own bodies can do. And so without that sort of inner judgment, they are not as safe. I thought that was very interesting. The other thing, I think we talked about this earlier a bit, but about food, you know, if you've noticed, if you go to an ethnic restaurant in the United States, there's rarely ever a child's plate or a kid's menu. There, and that's because in a lot of cultures around the world, as you certainly know, children don't eat separate foods from adults. They eat the same food as everyone else and eat together with them. And this sort of communal eating with everyone eating together encourages children to eat a wide variety of healthy food. One thing that I found very surprising in Japan was that there's a sort of belief that it's okay to let children you work it out even if they're going to fight. That doesn't mean that, you know, parents or teachers would not intervene if there were a fist fight or anything. But, but you know, in Japan, one of the cultural goals, very strong one, perhaps the most important one, is for people to really learn how to get along and to, you know, work well together in groups and all of that. And this is one way to do it, is that they let them sort of rub up against other children, other people, have these experiences and have the good feeling of making up as well. They have to sort of learn that for themselves without us guiding them too much through it. In Northern Europe, another tip is that, you know, children are expected to go outdoors every day, even in the winter, and babies even sleep outside in the winter. They have a saying that there's no such thing as bad weather, only bad clothing, which is something that I try to remember. In the United States, children get on average 4 to 7 minutes of outdoor time a day, which is very little. And then there's there's another area. This is about greetings. I'm not sure how it is in Malaysia, but in the cultures that I'm familiar with, cultivating greetings is a way to cultivate your kindness, because it sort of gives children this reminder that they acknowledge others, you know, that they don't ignore them or greet them if they want to, but not otherwise. And it's not the way we do this and the way I've seen parents do this in other cultures. It's not forced, but the expectation is always there. You know, greeting people, saying hello and goodbye to them, seeing them off at the door is just a fundamental sort of expectation, and it cultivates their feeling that they have a way to care for other people too.
Right.
In Sweden, I talked to an American woman who moved there and learned about this concept at their preschool, when she was very surprised that there was no fence at all. This was at a preschool for three-year-olds, and she was really quite baffled. You know, how would the children know that they shouldn't run off? And then she learned that in Sweden, there was this idea of teaching children self-control instead of our being the ones controlling them, giving them lots of chances to practice this self-control, which I think is something that we can learn from also. So part of that in this particular instance was that there was no fence, but they taught the children about an invisible fence that the children could kind of keep in mind and control themselves not to go beyond. So it was a way to hone that kind of practice at controlling yourself. I came across a very interesting study of Guatemalan children, where as toddlers, they were highly indulged. They were allowed to do whatever they wanted. They're never asked to give up a toy to a sibling so that they can learn how to share, which is something that we often do here. We treat our children as sort of equal, and we expect everyone has an equal right to, say, a toy, or, you know, they take turns, et cetera. But in this culture, as in a lot of indigenous cultures, actually, the younger ones are not really considered to quite be at that stage yet, and so they are allowed to not share. But as they get older, they've been modeled this really kind, generous, you know, indulgence, and they are able to turn that to their younger siblings or other younger children in the community and be generous. So I thought that was very interesting, a little bit of a different take on the whole idea of how you cultivate generosity. Co-sleeping is, you know, my first chapter is on co-sleeping, and I had sort of known this, but I hadn't quite realized that even in our own country, co-sleeping was so very common until about 100 years ago, and that in countries all over the world, people snuggle with their babies. And in our country, we are told that sleeping independently, teaching your child how to sleep independently from you, is going to help you raise an independent child. But in, you know, as you I'm sure know, in many other countries, there is this idea that children are meant to be dependent, especially in this arena. But we will cultivate their independence as they get older in many other ways. And research does show that children who co-sleep are more independent in some areas, such as self-care, self-reliance, than or advocating for themselves in a social situation, than children who do not sleep with their parents. And then I think the final thing that I learned is that, you know, parents in countries all over, from Greece to Spain to Brazil to Italy, really do believe children are best off, best raised when others are helping to raise them, whether that's the extended family or friends or the community or, you know, whoever. And so, you know, in Brazil, for instance, I'm told that many families even live in multi-generational housing, with three generations living together. Either they'll be in three homes that are very close to one another, or there will be three families, three different generations on different floors of the same house. I thought that was really lovely. It makes it easier for the village to pitch in. So those are some of the tips that I
Very true. I agree with that. I mean, there are wonderful things that you have mentioned. I got a couple of things that I do want to mention. The first one is you're talking about the multi-generational support group that we talk about. And that comes back again. Don't let that be misunderstood in terms of outsourcing teaching children's life skill. That's not the responsibility of the nanny, nor the babysitter, or the kindergarten, or, you know, whatever you want to call it. That is strictly in-house. What we're talking about here, yes, you do send your children to preschool to learn the ABCs of education, but certainly not about life skills. And then the other thing I do want to mention, this is a funny deal because I got into so much trouble growing up in Malaysia in terms of saying hello and goodbye to everyone and greeting in general, because what happened is that I could never remember the various titles, not necessarily. In Asia, I mean, my God, I mean, you know, my mother's sisters, in-laws, and the first cousin, and then on the father's side and all this, and it's like, are you kidding me? I'm just going to call everybody Uncle Auntie.
Right, that's so funny. Yeah, we have, it's the same in Korea with all the titles, depending on if it's your mother's older sister, your mother's younger sister, you know, father's side, and which, you know, how many families out from your family. It's very complicated. It's a lot to remember. My friends always thought it was funny that I didn't know the first names of a lot of my relatives, and that's because I was learning their titles.
The titles, And for me, what I did was I ended up to a point where I didn't want to go anywhere with my mom. And if I do, I'll be so quiet and sit in a little corner. And, of course, my mom is like, oh, my God, my son is a snob. You know, everybody's going to talk about Johnny, you know. It's like, and me, I'm not bringing my son up right. And I'm like, no, I, you know, I was like, it's, no, I can't remember all the titles. And the first cousin, second, twice removed and all that.
Yeah, I'd have a hard time with that, too.
Anyway, coming back to you, do you have a favorite parenting discovery in your research that you can share with us?
Well, let's see. There were so many. One that I think kind of gave me a little bit of strength was to discover that children don't necessarily always, you know, get a lot of material goods from, you know, toys, whatnot. I think that we sometimes can struggle in this country with children in the grocery checkout line or whatever asking. I know I certainly do with my younger ones asking for this or that, but I was kind of amazed to see children who weren't doing this and who were just very, you know, very contented with what they already had. And I think that that was, for me, a real inspiration. It just made me feel better about being able to say no, and we have, you know, we are very lucky because you have this and this, and, you know, there's no need for that. Because I think that we can get so sort of torn between wanting to be kind and please our child and then sort of taking the long-term view and knowing what's really kind of good for them. And I think that we can cultivate this sort of contentment with less. And that's a very good thing for children to learn within, you know, reason. It's tougher in our country because we live in one of the most commercialized nations in the world, especially when it comes to marketing toward children. And that is definitely, you know, I like to tell people it's not because of you that your child is pestering you for this or that. It's a strategy, and we're fighting against, you know, a lot of cultural pressure that tells our children that what they buy will make them happy. Mm-hmm. But knowing that that's there and knowing that that's why this is happening can be freeing, I think. And for me, it certainly has helped to just sort of say, you know, no about certain desires, or to offer, you know, that my children get an allowance and to say, you know, there's a lot of value. And if you really want something that badly, save up for it. Mm-hmm. And usually the desire actually then goes away.
Very, very interesting. You have a term that you use, hovering parenting, which is helicopter parenting. Mm-hmm. What is it?
Well, helicopter parenting, hover parenting, over parenting, that's gotten a lot of sort of press over the last 10 years or so. And it's really this phenomenon. Not everyone does it, but there is a little, it's definitely part of the idea of what good parenting means in American culture. And it's that you are there for your child. And your life is sort of child-centered and that your child's needs come first. I think this is very appropriate for a child's certain needs to come first when they're younger, but as they are older, it's not healthy to, it's undermining if you are too involved in your child's life, if you're micromanaging too many of their decisions, if you're deciding, helping them to make decisions that really children in other cultures or children when we were growing up were making on their own. And, you know, I heard stories about this from all sorts of teachers, especially from pre-K through mm-hmm. college professors, noticing the sort of impact that hover parenting or helicopter parenting has on children, because it just kind of takes away their autonomy if somebody mm-hmm. else is sort of making decisions for them. And so that's something that I think we are becoming more aware of and trying not to do. It's a tough balance.
Very interesting. What three practical parenting lessons can an American family adopt and implement that will be very helpful to them right now without much trouble?
Right. Well, I think that there are a few really, really simple things that one can do. One thing is to, never pick up your child's towel again if it's on the floor. Teach your child to fold her clothes and put them away and care for a few belongings completely on her own that we are often so rushed or just, you know, or we may be used to having done that when they were little and then it just kind of stayed that way. I think children, even from the age of 15 months around the world, show a desire to help out their community, their family. And what a lot of other cultures do is sort of ride on that. They go along with that. They really cultivate that. They take advantage of that natural impulse, and they really teach children how to be responsible and helpful. And so children in other cultures are often very capable of doing a lot of things that our children are less capable of. And one of those is small things like chores. Chores in America have decreased quite a bit over the last 25 years. And you know, when I did an informal poll in my book as well, generationally, mm-hmm. the older generations did far more than we do now. We are used to thinking of our children as, there's a Princeton sociologist, Viviana Zelliger, who says we think of our children now as economically worthless, but emotionally priceless. And I think that that really captures how we sort of view the expectations we have for our children. Mm-hmm. In terms of practical things that they can do, mm-hmm. We can really take advantage of their desire to help out. And mm-hmm. that helps to cultivate their kindness as well, because children who are helping others are more attuned to others. They're more aware of the needs of others. And so you're killing several birds with that stone. I think really if you can pick three different mm-hmm. chores in your mm-hmm. house, in your family, and have your child start doing them, that will really go a long way towards mm-hmm. a lot of the goals that American parents probably have for their children.
Very interesting. The number one thing on every parent's mind is how to educate their child. Mm-hmm. How can your book help them with this?
Well, I looked at different parenting paradigms. I looked at education in China, and I looked at education in Finland, and they're very, very different. I also looked at it in Japan, which is an interesting mix, I think, of the two. I looked at education in Korea as well, which has very, which does extremely well on international achievement tests. And I think that we, in our country, we do worry. There is this worry about overburdening or stifling our children, asking too much of them. And I think that what we can sort of trust is that, and what I found from looking at different cultures is that it is okay to have sort of high standards for what our children can do. At the same time, the most successful educational paradigms give children a lot of time to play and to do other activities, to work with their hands, to do art and to do music, and just sort of have free time, downtime. And I think that those really do need to be an essential part of education. More is not always better. It's just the quality of what you give them or what they get is really what's important. So that's what I would hope that parents who are interested in education could take away from my book.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Besides cultural issues, which we have talked at length, do you think economic issues also plays an important part in how children are being raised by their parents?
I think that it definitely does. I mean, parenting has become a more anxious, sort of endeavor over the last few, over the last decade or two. And a lot of this does have to do with our anxiety about how our children are going to do in the future. We don't have the sort of safety net that parents in many other cultures do. For some parents even, I remember hearing about one parent who said, well, I can't let my child climb a tree because I don't have insurance to pay if he breaks his bone, if he falls out of the tree and breaks his bone. And that is certainly a very valid sort of, issue. So I think that our country has some unique challenges when it comes to parenting, precisely because of economic issues. And parenting also is very different when you look at families from different socioeconomic backgrounds. So this is all very much a part of what is going on when it comes to parenting in the United States.
Very interesting. What would you like for the readers to gain from reading Parenting Without Borders?
That's a great question. I think I would like them to feel more confident about themselves. I definitely did not write this book to make parents feel inadequate. Because I think we already feel too inadequate. I actually want them to tap into, their instincts about, this is what I want for my child, and to understand that, well, those instincts are correct, and a lot of children around the world do thrive if you give them more time to play and yet have high standards for them in certain areas and teach them to be kind to others. And this kind of, conviction that what you're doing is sort of okay is something that I would like for parents to take away. I'd like them to also have a feeling of freedom from the idea that there is only one way to parent or that there are only certain ways to parent that are good, because I think that's a very oppressive idea, and it certainly is a strong one. I know that when I became a parent, it did feel like there are only certain ways to parent. Some are okay and some are not, and you don't want to be judged as the person who's a bad parent. But a lot of the things that I found in other cultures went directly against some of these ideas, and I found that very freeing. To find out.
Very interesting. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, my website is sort of a central hub. I think you can connect with me on Facebook or Twitter through that. And the website is, Christine Groslow, CHRISTINEGROSSLOH.com. That's where I'm trying to keep that website updated with the latest information. And I'd love to hear from people. I'd love to hear from people who have read the book or want to read the book or just have thoughts about global parenting that they want to share.
Very good. One of the things that we had talked earlier is how culture views human potential in your book.
Yes.
How has this influenced your parenting approach towards your children?
Well, you know, I think the one basic thing that it has changed is I'm kind of a little more aware of how I speak to them, so that I don't say things that might make them feel like, you know, like, oh, I can't do this, or I'm going to be afraid to try harder. I really just try to say things to them that show them that I think they are really capable of making a great effort, and that effort is all that I really, you know, ask and expect. And it's not because I expect it, you know, that they should be obligated to me, because I think that knowing that they can do that is going to be a great confidence booster as they grow older.
Very interesting. The Japanese and the Americans believe in personal genius in your book that talks about traits from intelligence to eyesight and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit more about that. And actually, this is something that, to me, coming from a different culture, is very, very important, because it does allow us to be focused on the things that we do best, rather than trying to sort of being herded into a certain scenario that may not be quite fitting for us.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, we often hear, for instance, that people say, you know, my child is, you know, or I'm not good at art, or, oh, I'm not really musical, et cetera. And, of course, I hear people, Japanese people, say these things as well. And yet the difference is that, because there's also a lot of research that backs this up. You know, practice is also really an important part of what makes you become better at something. And so if you start out with the assumption that you're not good at something, and so that tracks you out of something immediately, or you're not going to make a genuine effort, and then you're going to put less time into it, then you really aren't going to be able to be good at it, because you won't have put the time into it. That said, I think, you know, so there's a lot more time for art or music class in Japan, for instance, than there is in most American schools. And there's really a belief that you can get good at these things, or other areas as well. And I do think, so the downside of this kind of pervasive belief that anyone can get good at anything is that, right, there's a ceiling. There is a ceiling, and I don't, you know, I don't want my children, I'm sure, you know, most of us don't want our children to feel inadequate. So what I love is the way that being in America gives us a lot of permission to really pursue your passions and what you're really, really good at, or what you think you would have enough sustained interest in to become good at, because you would be practicing it. That said, I also don't think that you have to be good at everything to, you know, things to enjoy them necessarily. Enjoyment can come from a lot of other things as well.
Mm-hmm. Very true. Very true. Well, does your parents, as grandparents to your children, get involved with them a whole bunch? We talk about the global village kind of thing, of it takes a village to raise the child. Have they influenced your children pretty much in some way?
Well, I think that they, we unfortunately don't live near them, so we see them as often as we can, but they're very present in their lives. They, we FaceTime, you know, we do Skype or video camera with my parents as often as we can, and I know they talk with my husband's parents as well quite a bit, and we just sort of keep them involved. And, you know, from my parents, for instance, they've learned a love of Korean food, and my mother is a much better cook when it comes to Korean cooking than I am. So my children love that sort of thing, and they love just the when we get together with them, sitting around the table, all of us eating together. And they're like, these memories are being woven into the fabric of their lives. They will always remember these kinds of moments, and we really try to encourage as much of that as possible.
Fantastic. Mother's Day is coming up this Sunday. Would you like to do a shout out to all your loved ones?
Yes, of course. I mean, I have so many people in my life. I have my own sort of very supportive village, all my family and my husband's family, and so many wonderful friends. I am really grateful to my parents. I have this in my book, in my acknowledgments, but I do feel that they raised me in an incredibly open and supportive way, and gave us all this sort of belief, you know, that we can, that anything is possible, which is a very American sentiment, and I love mm-hmm. that.
Wonderful. Anyone else?
My husband, of course, and my children. I mean, they have been the whole reason for writing this book. It's just like almost, you know, they're just always present in my life, and truly, I want the very best for all of them.
Fantastic. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
Oh, that's such a great tradition that you have on your show, and I'm honored to. So I'm not, like, when I cook very much sort of in a, without measuring. I just throw things together. So I'll throw a few things together here. I'd say a dash of, you know, following your own instincts. Reaching deep into yourself to sort of see what you really believe is best for you and your family, and having the courage to follow that, even if the cultural norms around you aren't always supportive of that. You know, not being led by fear. I think that a sprinkle of courage is very important to remember that sometimes our motivations are fear-based and can be very helpful in eliminating that. And I think most of all, it's just really important to strive for joy and for connection with other people. Parenting is about teaching children to connect with you and to you know, so that they can be ready to really connect with that wider world out there. And I think that that is really one of the most important things in raising children for me, and I think for a lot of people.
Wonderful. And what I gather in the end, the most important thing is effective communication. And communication is a two-way street.
It really is. It definitely is a two-way street.
Wonderful. Dr. Christine, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending the hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be best-selling author Rabbi Wayne Dossick. Rabbi Dossick and I will be talking about his latest book titled The Real Name of God, Embracing the Full Essence of the Divine. This is based on his finding in the shared knowledge of biblical source religion, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, affirming our oneness, one God, one world, and one people. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening. Have a blessed week and happy Mother's Day. Dr. Christine, thank you again.
Thank
and
you
have
so
a blessed
much.
Day.
Thank
You're welcome.
You.
And happy Mother's Day.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Goodbye.